2018 Health Bond Oversight Board meeting. If anybody had a chance to view our minutes from our last meeting.
I'll second.
All in favor? Opposed? So all are in favor? Looks like there's no need for an executive session. Kathy, do you have a licensing report for us?
Yes, I do. I just wanted to remind everybody that currently the roll is going around, so if you haven't signed it, make sure that you actually do sign it. And I just want to reiterate to everybody that it's a good thing to check your agents monthly to make sure that their license is up to date. And, you know, you can always go on our website. And basically, when you're on our website on the left-hand side, it has a magnifying glass and it says, look at the company, agency, or individual agent. And if you put in your agency's name, it shows the agents, the city, the license number, and the activity date. And just a reminder, according to producer licensing, an agent can renew their license up to 70 days prior to their expiration date. So they don't have to renew it the month that it would expire, they can renew it before. And it's the cost for a limited line producer license with a qualification of bell is just $50 plus whatever cost was going to process it.
So let me, if I understand you correctly, I can renew before my expiration month.
Yes, you can.
That's good to know. That doesn't change your expiration date for the next year either. It still remains the same, the month of your birth, right?
Yes. Just to kind of go over the report too, there really wasn't a lot of reinstated licenses, but again, make sure one of the things that we're checking on is how many days your license was down, because obviously with that, if you're writing any bonds or the agency was responsible, that becomes more of an issue. There were quite a few licenses that did lapse. You know, so now some people are just finding that they don't want to be in the bell industry, but if there's somebody on the list that happens to be to your agency, and you should have received a letter, well, an email, and they should have received an email that their license had lapsed, so.
Right.
That's a good follow-up for you.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, how frequently is the website updated with that information? Is it daily? Is it live?
My understanding, Steve, do you know?
It's pretty quickly.
The license is live.
Yes.
It pulls right out of CIRCOM, and so just kind of on that.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you. I've got a question.
Yes.
As a principal owner of the agency, if I myself chose never to write a bond again, I have to have an agent license?
Well, according to the qualifications that when you were collaterally backed or insured back, one of the agents has to have 2,000 hours. It's a designated person that's responsible. Generally speaking, that's the.
So then they require an agent.
Yes.
Do you have a summary of any enforcement reports?
Yes. Well, basically, what we've got going, there wasn't an awful lot that actually happened as far as investigations. We did have in audits. Excuse me, I did finish 8 audits during that time. I kind of wanted to go a little bit more into that because that does go into the enforcement reports. But, you know, some audits when I'm doing them, I find that the agency has no code violations at all. And as we have talked before, basically I send out a synopsis of everything that had happened and what I looked at and what the results were. Some of the audits that I conducted actually did have some violations that resulted in private letters. Some audits actually actually resulted in a forfeiture amount. And I have actually started three more audits. And again, I want to reiterate, prior to an audit, approximately 2 weeks, I sent out a letter. And I also sent out a request for certain information to the agency. And the request is very, very basic. I asked for a list of all the current employees that you've got. I asked for a list of the active bonds and evidence of your bonding ability. I asked for a sample check from your trust checking account and a sample check from your operating account. And I asked for a copy of the trust signature account card as well as the operating account signature card. And then I'm asking for bank statements, and they're for all of your accounts, and it's generally speaking a year's worth. I asked for a copy of your trust account ledgers. If you've actually got a trust account, you should have a ledger. And I asked for a copy of your bonding agreement and bond. Basically, I'm looking for what you filed or your surety has filed for your agency in CERFON. I asked for a copy of any of your marketing materials. And a lot of times you're talking about with DAX, or you're talking about a billboard, or you're talking about something like that. If you've had any independent audits, I asked for a result of that. If you're surety backed.
Independent from your own.
Yes,
from another agency or something like that.
And that's what I was saying. If you're surety backed, your surety insurer does perform audits periodically to see where you are with their records. And so that's always a good thing to have, a copy of. And then I ask for bonding paperwork written in certain months, about 3 months, so that I can basically pick bonds and make sure that everything is according as it should be.
You would probably say that the lack of recent enforcement cases is because we've just really shaped up and as an industry and we're performing so well.
Oh, I would really like to say that, and a lot of times it's true, but I'd also like to say that some of the same problems that have occurred are the ones that continue to occur. So we're talking about the trust accounts. We're, you know, things of that nature. So that's, again, that's one of the reasons we remind you. That's one of the reasons we do audits. We try to educate you. Anytime anybody has a question, I'm more than willing to, you know, step through any process that you have a question regarding.
Good. If I remember correctly, last time we had a meeting, you had somewhere around 7 to finish up the year. Does that mean you've pretty much gone through the whole industry and now you're re-rounding? Or
continuing to go through. Yeah, I did the 7, so they're all done, and that's what I was saying, that I had outstanding. I've got 3 that I've started, and as soon as those 3 get done, then I will be just continually going through and addressing new agencies for years out, also addressing other agencies as far as when their last audit was. So it is a continuous round.
Now, say there was a new agency that was to start a business. How long would you prefer them to be in business before you wanted to do maybe your first audit on them?
We do it generally about a year.
About a year.
And one of the reasons we do it is again, when I'm requesting information, I'm requesting bank records for a year. Mm-hmm. So what we've done is by doing that, I'm establishing, or you're establishing, these are your business practices, and you're doing it according to the code, or you're not. Mm-hmm. And so there's a pattern that can be looked at.
For other than new agencies, what is kind of the time frame in terms of
every 3 to 5 years?
3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm.
Are they randomly selected, or do you have a particular?
I go through the list and I look at the last time that they were.
They've been audited.
Yes.
So
yes.
It's not. It's just they're bound to get audited between. Right.
Yeah, and I also actually do pull if there's a concern about an agency, if we've got some complaints or some investigations, those will move to the forefront, and we'll look at auditing them, even if they're audited. Has just been a few months or a year or two before,
Can I ask a question about what as you've done this amount of audits, I guess, during the last year, what do you find is the most prevalent or most common, for lack of a better word, infraction or just veering from the beat from the path?
Basically, what I see a lot of, or well, maybe not a lot, but it's probably one of my big concerns, is that the trust money that you're taking, the cash collateral, that you're putting it in the right account, that you're not commingling the money and transferring it back and forth to your operating account, that you're doing it correctly, that you're keeping the record correctly, that you've got your ledger, that your ledger actually says, okay, this bond was written on this date, it was exonerated on this date and we sent the money out. Sometimes you're going to have money that's going to stay in your trust account because that person has basically left and you don't have any way to contact them. You know, that is an issue, that is a problem, but that money can't be transferred.
It's making sure that money stays trust.
Right. Okay. And then there's, just the making sure that you're filling out the correct forms, that you're using the correct forms. Sometimes when you're talking about a surety insurer, they're filing all the forms for you, and you're supposed to be on top of that with your surety, making sure that you're using the correct forms. Sometimes they have addendums to their forms, and so you've got to make sure that if you're collaterally backed, you're filing your own forms. But again, you've just got to make sure that you're going through and making sure that all the information is correct according to the rules and according to the code, that your forms are filed correctly.
Thanks.
Kathy, I have a question about trust accounts, and that you brought up something that there could be possibly money in one's trust account. The case has been exonerated, and the person's whose collateral it is MIA.
Mm-hmm. I know we've talked about that before
And what would you recommend the procedure be? I mean, there a certain amount of time should pass, obviously, to give the person an opportunity to come back for their money. And after, I mean, I guess what I'm getting at is there a standard time frame that we should all be adhering to before we take the money and send it off to the state to return, for unclaimed money or what? I'm not even sure about that.
Eternity.
Yes. I don't see anything in the code that specifically states a certain date.
Yeah. I'm not aware of anything either. Just was asking the question in case you were. So.
Would it fall under unclaimed money?
Statutorily, isn't there a statutory for unclaimed? Yeah, at some point it was cheat to the state.
Right.
And I know Ms. Babbles has helped the insurance department when we have had funds from, say, an insolvent insurer, we'll get a check and there's nothing we can do with it. There's a form that I think it goes to the treasurer's office. And
yes.
I don't know if you can speak to your experience.
I can't remember the number of years now. 8 seems to be in my head, but I don't know why.
Is that something maybe we could figure out? And
one more.
Yep. All right, easy to find out, but I don't know the answer today. But it's about 8 years. And then you have to turn it over to
the state.
Unclaimed property, right? It's a division within the treasurer's office, but they are not housed in the capital by the treasurer. They're on Redwood Road somewhere.
Does the bill agent have to have annual documentation to that account as to why it's still in trust or anything like that?
If I'm understanding you correctly, they've got their records and their ledgers, have got when the bond was written, the amount that was put in there. That's where they're keeping the records.
Okay, so as long as it's in the ledger, you don't have to have any additional documentation. And this is still here because we haven't been able to.
Yeah, no, you've just got your ledger already documented. It's something that, if I have a question with your ledger, and it has happened, everybody's ledger is, unique to them. And so sometimes I will go ahead and call a person and say, I've been looking, I can't see where this notation is. And then, it's just a dialogue to make sure that the information is there.
Mm-hmm. we'll move on to new business. Oh, Wayne, you have a question?
I got a question relative to the collateral that your people you're holding for are missing. Mm-hmm. Before you do anything with the money, you might want to check with the court on that case number to make sure that the docket is showing that you are exonerated, because I know our agencies had some cases reopened by the judges, unbeknownst to us, so you might want to defer back to the docket before you do anything.
Meaning the case appeared to be closed at one time and then mysteriously at another time it was reopened and still existed. All right, well, we'll move to new business. Kathy, you have a little bit of a presentation or something to talk about on paying our judgments and what may happen to us if we don't and it winds up coming to your desk.
Right. You know, we do talk about this because on all my reports, I'm always showing you an investigation and it'll say a forfeiture judgment. Typically speaking, when you're looking at 7720B, the bail surety, it addresses the entry of non-appearance, the time for bringing the defendant to court, defendants in custody, forfeiture of bail, and the revocation of the bail bond. So typically speaking, when I get involved with it, it's because there's been a judgment of forfeiture that the prosecutor has taken out. So it's already gone through the process at court. All the notifications have been already done. So what happens is if a judgment of forfeiture has been done at the court and the prosecutor will send out a letter, they give you 15 days to pay this forfeiture judgment. And it does tell you that it would be sent to the Department of Insurance if it's not paid. So under 31A35504, it addresses the failure to pay the bail bond forfeiture and the grounds for suspension and revocation of bail bond agency license. When a prosecutor notifies me of a failure to pay a forfeiture judgment, I do the following. I open an investigation, and I prepare a letter of forfeiture that indicates the following. And I've included a copy in there of the letter that is sent out. But basically, what it says is the name of the prosecutor, the court, the defendant, the court case number, and the notification also refers to 31A35504 and explains that an agency has 5 business days following the notification for failure to satisfy the judgment, that you have those 5 days to satisfy that particular judgment. The letter refers to the date that the department must receive written notice from the prosecutor that the forfeiture has been satisfied and refers to the date that a mandatory order of suspension will commence. So when I get all this prepared, I call the agency and I alert them to the forfeiture judgment. So that's one of the first things I do is I call you and I let you know. I also send the letter via email and mail. And generally speaking, within the days that you've been allotted, the agency pays the judgment, they send me a copy of the payment, the prosecutor will contact me or the clerk of the court contacts me and lets me know that a satisfaction has been done and sends me a copy of it. And that's generally the end of it because it's taken care of. Occasionally, an agency gets the telephone call from me, they get the letter from email, they get the letter in the mail, and I've even talked to them about the whole process, obviously, and the 5 days expire, and the agency has not paid that judgment to the court. So according to the code, I have a mandatory order of suspension is done at that particular point in time, and the commissioner is the one that signs that mandatory order. The mandatory order is no fewer than 14 days, okay? Once that order is signed, we send a copy to the courts so that they are aware. I call all the jails, and I leave them a message. I try to talk to whoever is over that area and let them know what's going on. Then we have to make sure that in those 14 days, we're checking to see if we get written notice from the prosecutor that the debt has been paid. And we have to make sure that there's no other notice of any other unpaid forfeitures from the prosecutor. Occasionally what has happened, and we've seen it, where an agency has received a forfeiture judgment, but it's also indicative because they're already in trouble financially, and so there are other forfeiture judgments.
It's all piling on.
Yeah, they're piling on, and I'm being notified by different courts of those notices. So if a notice of an NEFT forfeiture is received, we need to know that forfeiture has been paid, and the prosecutor lets me know that. And if the agency fails to meet the above conditions, the commissioner shall commence an administrative proceeding and revoke the license of the agency within 60 days following the initial date of the suspension. So really what you've got is a minimum of 14 days once you get to a mandatory suspension. And then you've got 5 days after that if you pay that forfeiture judgment and you have no other out there, and then your license can be reinstated. Mm-hmm. But if you go 60 days past the initial date, then we move to do administrative action to revoke the agency's license.
Has that ever happened where you actually revoked an agency license for failure to pay forfeitures, period?
Yes, we've done that twice in the last year.
And those, would you characterize those people as just basically folding up and walking away from it? They're just kind of just forgetting all their obligations, or are they still trying to?
Well, what happens, that brings up a good point. What happens when a bail agency has all the forfeiture judgments and we revoke their license? The courts at that particular point in time age out those forfeiture judgments and send them to the Office of State Debt Collection. We had a representative here, two of them before, from the Office of State Debt Collection, and they talked to what actually happens at the Office of State Debt Collection. They, under the law, they actually add quite a few different fees, interest rates, et cetera, are quite high with them, but they go after the assets of the agency or the principals. So, and they take their state taxes. If they're going to get a refund, they take that. Their collection methodology is good, and they are in the process right now of a few that I'm very aware that they're in court with order to show causes for forfeiture judgments to get the collateral back.
These are companies that are no longer
operating. No longer have a valid license or license standing up, but they have assets.
You know, that's justice, and I'm all for justice, you know, so.
You know what, before it gets to that point, and I'll tell you from experience, and Kathy knows this, I had a forfeiture that I had a co-signer that I had to wait on the money, and if you were super nice to the court, those clerks will work with you.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Vivian, bring me $1,000. And we'll make a payment arrangement and you can get the full payment.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, Kathy knows, the court knows they're taking payments. Weaver, not so much. You don't really have to get to that far. You can file a motion to go before the judge and see if you can get payments before you let your license be suspended.
Right.
Yes,
a
question. The department just suspended last week an agency for failure to pay a judgment.
Yes.
And I'm curious if the insurance company that underwrites them was also suspended for failure to pay.
I can tell you that this particular forfeiture judgment was taken prior to that particular agency being aligned with the surety that you're...
That's not possible. That particular agency has been surety bound for about 4 or 5 years, ever since his divorce.
We have we have got the forfeiture judgment, and we're taking the appropriate steps based upon that particular forfeiture judgment.
Sounds good.
So what does happen to the surety, if they're surety by it?
Under the code where we've been going, and correct me if I'm wrong, Terry, okay? But under the code where we're going, we go after the surety agency, and that's where we start, is once the court is noticed, generally speaking, they notice the agency, and they will notice the surety insured. So they have all that information that they're noticing, and they're taking out the forfeiture judgment. But when we get it from the prosecutor, they're first going with the agency or the surety agency that we're noticing that they have not paid the forfeiture judgment. So we're starting the time frame immediately with that particular agency and going forward that way. Generally speaking, if you got a surety insured, the agency is contacting them and getting the money from the bank account to pay it. If they don't,
okay, there's a three-way cut agreement there, so if the agency is having difficulty with the surety, and the surety's all of a sudden having some difficulties or something, it might not necessarily be the agency's fault. Of course, that's pretty rare, but I could see that possibility.
Well, in the instances where we have surety insured back in an agency, the surety, the agency hasn't paid it in the judgment, so we revoked their license. So that's where we start.
In the end, the surety pays the bond.
Yeah, I think what Gary is referring to is that, let's say the agency doesn't pay it, the surety is ultimately responsible. If they don't pay it, then they should be punished by whoever they represent in the state of Utah. I think that's what we're referring to, right?
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, the buck stops at the surety level. If they don't pay it, then I'm assuming they are suspended from riding bail in the state until they pay it.
Right, but then my question goes to, once an agency is a complaint comes in on the agency for not paying, is there any trigger that goes towards the surety if they're surety back?
I think what she's saying is they start with the surety, with the agency. If the agency fails to...
But if the surety, ultimately, if the surety doesn't pay, where does that go? Does that come back to the department?
The court...
Because sureties are under
right.
The department.
The court will notice the surety and the agency at the time when they start the process. So they are taking out the forfeiture judgment. If it gets to that point, they're taking it out in the surety's name and the agency's name. We start with the agency because that's where they start, or the prosecutor alerts us to the forfeiture judgment. That's where we start. And what we have happened with the surety is they, or at least where I've seen it, the sureties have actually come through and paid, but the agency's license could be suspended or revoked because they
So basically the agency's got to front the money if they
want to keep writing bail.
Yeah. Which is, right. You're looking at the risk that you're assuming when you write that bond initially, so you've got to make sure that your risk is a solid one.
Kathy, when you get a call from a court or a prosecutor about failure to pay a judgment, do you automatically open a case, or is there a grace period before you start an actual case?
Okay, I open a case when I get the, generally speaking, it's an email, but I get the entire packet from the court. I get a letter from the prosecutor. I get a copy of the forfeiture judgment. I get a copy of the motion. I get a copy, basically, of all the paperwork that is reflective of that particular forfeiture judgment. When I send the letter to the agency, I'm sending a copy of all the paperwork that I have received from the prosecutor. So there's nothing that the agency shouldn't have already received prior that they're not receiving again. Now, occasionally what's happened is an agency will come to me and say, you know, this due process, this piece, was skipped, and so I really have some questions about this. I will go ahead and contact, and I have our I've contacted the courts, and I've actually contacted our attorney just to see if there's a reason why we shouldn't go forward at that particular point in time. Sometimes there are, and then I will shut the investigation down, but I contact the prosecutor and let them know that this is a problem. It doesn't happen often. I think it's happened maybe about 3 times in the last 5 years. So generally speaking, that prosecutor has done the correct steps in the forfeiture judgment process before they've even sent it to me.
Okay. So it doesn't reflect the number. It does reflect the number or that we're seeing when you compile the list for
yes.
us. So that's that. Okay.
Okay.
So there is no grace period. You get the information from the court.
And yes. Gotcha.
Statute says it, but if I go ahead and get it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which has happened, I'm not going to go ahead and do that 5-day start the clock. Then I do it, get it ready, and give you that extra day. But I will call you that day.
I just noticed because you have a 3-day open and close on here, and I thought, well, that's pretty rapid. I wonder,
you know what happens a lot? The minute I call, the agency is going, oh my gosh, Kathy got a hold of me, and I'm running right now to the court.
Okay.
In fact, I said to one of the agency, don't put a check in the mail. That drives me nuts. And no, you can't call them and pay that. You have to get it into the court.
Let me ask for bail side. Has there been any issues with the prosecutors not getting information to you that
there was a judgment?
Yeah.
Yes. I have that personal experience. Kathy got a hold of me for that very reason, because there was a judgment out there that I was unaware of, and the courts didn't want to come to me about it. They figured they'd just go to Kathy, and she'd act quicker. So. And like Kathy said, she called me, and I was hop, skipping, and jumping over to the court as quick as I could.
Okay, so. I ask that simply because I know that there are prosecutors out there who are very hostile to this industry.
Yeah. I believe that there are actually judgments out there in existence that Kathy still doesn't know about. And either the prosecutor isn't calling her about them or anything like that. So they're just sitting out there floating to this day.
I had the Utah Office of Debt Collections call me on a bond, and I hadn't heard from Kathy, so it had already bypassed that and went to the debt collection.
Actually, that took some while for the courts to understand that they could come to you for that.
Right. And in fact, not too long ago, I had to call Kim Allard, who is over the administrative courts, and say, we need to revisit it again because you've got some new clerk of the courts and they're not understanding what service we can work on together. And so this just happened last week, and a case was recalled from the Office of State Debt Collection. I've asked to attend their next clerk of the court meeting when they're doing their training so that we can revisit how this piece can work.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular prosecutors that you know of that are, as you say, hostile?
Pardon?
Are there particular prosecutors that, as you say, that you know of that are hostile?
Well, I know a couple of them.
It'd be easier to name some.
I'm not going to mention names.
Okay.
More than that.
Well, just so you know, there are many that are very diligent, give extra time, extra notice.
But you're gonna see this from
and
from
give the benefit of the doubt.
Of course, you got
with them.
No matter what occupation, you've got a range from super diligent to pretty crappy, right?
Sure.
So, no matter what industry it is, we got to watch for those crappy ones, and because they can screw up everybody else.
I don't know
if we need to do something. Maybe Senator Adams and his, with his efforts, maybe he'd be able to look at some forcing the courts and the prosecutors to go through more of a detailed procedure on that, so that that's documentable.
I can tell you. I can tell you specifically that I have received judgment of forfeitures from the prosecutor. I've notified the agency, and the agency has come back with, a problem, and I've contacted the prosecutor. And there are times when that prosecutor will pull that judgment of forfeiture back and try to make arrangements or work with that entity. So the prosecutor, at least in my experience, the prosecutors that I've worked with directly, they are very open, or they appear to be very open and have worked with me and the agency. So I did want to make that a clear.
So what these two couple of prosecutors, I know it's all this.
Maybe I can go on with them.
It could very well be.
No, I've been doing this for a while, but I will tell you that when it comes to the courts, the name of the game is check and double check and then double check again, because the courts do make mistakes also. So it's not uncommon not to get a forfeiture even though one's been processed. It's not uncommon to not be notified of a forfeiture at all. It's probably not uncommon that you've gotten a notification from a court that a forfeiture hasn't been paid when it has been paid. Does that happen?
Yes, it has.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just need to be real aware of what records are out there and make sure you're confirming them.
So does this still need to be revisited?
At least in my opinion, it's working well. I brought it up more so because we've just had a big mandatory order suspension that just occurred last week. And so I just really wanted to emphasize most of the time, the agencies are really good about taking care of it when I first notify them.
I don't mean so much for the agencies. I'm talking about the relationship between some of these hostile prosecutors and how they handle things. Maybe they're not being as fair as they need to be or as diligent as they're supposed to be in making sure that the agents are given notification before it goes to you.
Kurt, in the past that was a problem, but they've automated that system somewhat in the past couple of years, and it's been much more efficient. Granted, they're much more diligent about it as well. So I don't think that's a evasive issue, so to speak.
I'd say we need to keep watch on them.
For sure.
Because, I've dealt with the courts for 12 years.
There's a couple of catch-22s that are in place to pretty much ensure that a bondsman knows that a judgment is right on his doorstep, and that you have to properly be notified about the FTA to begin with. If the courts haven't properly done that, then it's all null and void anyhow. And so, as an operator, if you understand that you have an FTA, we all are clear to understand we have 180 days on it. I find it pretty difficult for an operator to. I know that there's opportunities for the rare instance to happen, but as a whole, I think being notified about your judgments. Well, I guess what I'm getting at is you probably are aware of the judgment before it even happens. Meaning, if it's not on your radar and you're not panicking about it trying to resolve the problem, you might have bigger problems than having Kathy calling you up and your judgment.
Well, that's what I want to know. Is it truly a problem? Because apparently it's
I think it happens, and again, it's annoying because I don't like to be looked at as being doing wrong at all. And so, like for my particular instance, I don't want any attention from the insurance department for anything I don't believe I was guilty of. And so, when that happens, it's annoying. But
Well, I think if we address it on a case-by-case basis,
it's not that prevalent.
If we get a complaint from a bondsman or an agency about a prosecutor that has been hostile, I think we should address it at that time and just do it as a case-by-case.
I'll speak to something that Steve mentioned too. I'll echo that I know for a fact that there are more favorable prosecutors operating out there towards us bail bondsmen than unfavorable, because if they decided to bear down on us, we'd all be in a world of trouble. I know that. So, and I know I get lots of benefit of the doubt from them. We all do. All right. Well, if anybody has anything else on the not paying your judgments, then we'll move on to another subject, this cash-only bail. This is something that we talked about a little bit last year. We had a bulletin from the commissioner telling bail bondsmen that we are not to do cash bail, we're only to do bail bonds. And I know there was some objection to that within the industry. Some people said, well, can I do this, can I do that? And then we never really heard anything else about it. And so I was just thought it would be a good idea to revisit the subject, find out if there's been anybody who's been in trouble for it in the past, and what recommendations we might want to give anybody to try and stay in compliance.
All right.
I don't think there's been any change. The bulletin is in effect. There's been no change to the bulletin. The statutes that are referenced in the bulletin have not been amended or altered other than one reference to a code site. So I don't see that the law has changed. I mean, is that the question you have?
Kind of. And what I was getting at is if that's still the position of the insurance department, that we're not to do any cash bail as agencies, as businessmen, we're going to try and find the loophole around that. Does that mean we go out and open up a financial lending company on the side, and we switch our hats and say, well, I'm AAA bail bonds right now, but now I'm AAA lending, and lend them the cash bail and use a separate set of paperwork that you guys don't get to see?
Are you asking for legal advice?
Yes. I'm asking my regulators to tell me how I can stay in compliance.
That is a business decision for you to make on your own, I believe. Not something that your regulator should tell you how to conduct your business.
Well, okay, then just say this.
You should not be cash bail if you're solely licensed.
Let me put it this way. Then are we okay to open up a second lending business and do cash bail with impunity?
That's our position to answer that question.
Who would it be then?
Your attorney.
Your attorney. Private attorney.
And if all you right, noticed, Jerry, case there is an open case for selling cash only bail contracts on.
Right.
Okay.
I do know that. The industry has lots of questions about it. That was the reason why it was brought up.
Okay.
We'll ask our attorney about it.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's the department's position to tell you how to run your business or what kind of
No. The department tells us about all kinds of things we can and cannot
under the purview of insurance. But if you want to be a lending institution, that certainly is not something.
It was the insurance department that told us not to get into the cash only business, and so I would always expect them to be able to tell us a little bit about what we should do about it. Go ahead, Wayne.
I have a question. I had this inquiry, and that's why needs to be answered. And that's, an agent goes down and does a bond. They're ready to kick the person out, and then they find out they've got a $200 cash bail. And so the people say, well, I'm giving you all my money, I don't have any money. Can that agent act on their own behalf and give them the money or not? Not as a bail bond agent, but just as a person. Can that happen or can it not? And that's the question I've been asked. The department doesn't have a position on that, or do they?
I guess it would it matter if you charge them a fee for giving them that $200?
Well,
right?
that's again.
Now, there's a lot of facts that I think need to be.
I thought we were told is if you were a licensed bail bond agent, you could not pay that money regardless.
Only if it was given to you by the defendant or the family just to deliver.
Just to deliver.
Just to be
as
a courier.
Deliver, yeah, just
right.
As what we decided.
It really doesn't identify them in the code. If it's a bail bond agent, it's just that. Talks about the agency, so that's the question. And if they're not acting
really
on behalf of
question,
the agency,
but maybe if you guys have specific questions, put them in writing so that the facts don't alter.
Maybe I could just mention one thing that, you know, a problem, even if you were to do cash bail as the agency, one thing that I saw happen in court. With somebody who tried to do that was once the bond or the bail was going to be refunded or you know, back to the on appearance and hadn't been forfeited, an attorney for the bond agency showed up trying to get the judge to give it to them. But bail cannot be refunded to an agency. Once the bail is put in, it is the defendant's. Until it's forfeited, it's in trust for the defendant. So that money has to go back to the defendant, and then the surety or the agency would have to somehow try and get it back.
Not necessarily.
Yeah.
Because the jails now have to, we were ordered from a state auditor, that we have to identify the individual who is bringing the cash in by name, address.
Well, I'm sorry, once it comes to the court, is what I'm saying. Once it's under the court,
they refund it to whoever brought the money.
No, but that's how it's supposed to be.
That's how most judges take that down. And they're being audited to that by the state.
It
sounds like there's some confusion because I remember reading that Supreme Court case that the Office of the Court Administrator brought against, it was like some country or something. You remember that one?
Yeah, we had it.
That talked about bail goes back to the defendant, but then it sounds like you're getting different information from another source.
Our district court administrator told us they were audited and that our facility had to start identifying by name, address, any information we could get, who brought the money there. And we said, wait a second, this is a financial deal between the defendant and the person bringing the money. We're just taking the money for the defendant. How they handle it after the fact with them, they said, absolutely not. You need to record who brings them. So we had to change our practices within the last year.
Maybe I shouldn't have brought that up because I didn't realize that there was some confusion on there.
There always is.
That was a problem.
I was just saying it as, even if we didn't follow the letter or the policy, there's some serious problems that you're going to run into.
And I would be lucky, so, Gordon, as the person bringing, or sorry, Wayne, as the person bringing the caution. The jail would be identifying you to the court that you were the one that brought the cash.
And that's your jail.
But that would come under a different.
That
would come under a different board.
There's not supposed to be 20 other versions, but that's how it's.
I was just saying, here's another good reason to follow the board.
Yeah.
But you know, anyhow, didn't mean to poke the bear on that one.
It's a big bear.
All right. Well, talk to our attorneys on the cash bail. We'll move on to old business, or unless you have something. Oh, go ahead, Gary.
Regarding this bulletin from our esteemed commissioner, the second paragraph, it says, a bail agency may only sell bail bonds, no other products or services. I guess I've got to take some exception to that. If I'm licensed as a bail agent, that means that I can't be a landlord. That means I can't distribute my daughter's Girl Scout cookies. That means that the only function in that office, under the color of my agency, is to write a bail bond.
It says in a criminal transaction, they may only do that.
But that isn't what's indicated.
That's what it says.
In a criminal bail transaction. A bail bond agency may only sell bail bonds.
So Girl Scout cookies could not be sold in a criminal bail transaction. You're correct.
Stolen cookies.
Yes. You're dead on. You're dead on.
No, but you couldn't sell somebody a bail bond and a box of cookies at the same time. You would have to sell them a bail bond and then turn around and call yourself Gary, the cookie salesman, and sell them cookies.
Well, do those proceeds, because I'm holding them in trust for the Girl Scout Council?
As long as you have a ledger.
You won't be holding those Girl Scout cookies in your business trust. I'd be watching you carefully.
All right, we'll move on to old business. Now, last meeting we had a speaker here named J.L. Weber from Bail USA, and he was speaking to us a little bit about how rosy our future might be if we can only get through the tough times ahead. And Kurt, I believe you asked for some information from Mr. Weber, and he was supposed to get with you, Kathy, to get us some information about cash bail and how they were dealing with it in Colorado.
Yeah, pretrial release.
Right. He has not, so I will follow up and I will contact him and get that information.
It would be nice to know. It would give us some idea of, I mean, I think that we can learn something from what Colorado's done before us, so it would be interesting to know.
So I think sooner the better. Mm-hmm. I'd like to review that before the next meeting if we can.
It might also be relevant information for us to use in our upcoming, you know, fight that we're in. So the sooner the better, obviously.
All right. I'll get a hold of him.
Thank you, Captain.
And then you could distribute that information you get from him when you get it to to the board and, I guess, other interested parties, the same distribution list that Steve.
Right.
Is there any other business?
Mr. Chair, I just two things. One, on the legislative front, Commissioner Kaiser's Insurance Department Amendment Bill, HB 39, came out in the November interim session. There's nothing in that bill with regard to bail. The department hasn't seen any bail bills or are aware of any. We are aware that one legislator, and I don't know which one, has a what the legislators refer to as a boxcar bill, that there's bail in the title, but we don't have any information as to what's in there. So once that bill, if it does come out, we'll track that, and it'll be on our website, the department's website, under legislation. So you can look at that. And then I called Keisa Williams at the court administrator's office. She's the one that's...
She's the one.
Everyone knows who she is. And asked her if there was any updates that would be appropriate or any updates I could give to this group today. And she didn't have any. I do note, as I've communicated with Wayne just before this meeting, the pretrial release, the Supreme Court's pretrial release committee is scheduled to meet tomorrow at noon. I understand from Wayne that he may not be able to attend, but that he has been in contact with Keisa to have somebody else fill his shoes as a board member or committee member. And I also understand that, well, so those are not public meetings in the sense of like what the legislature has. There is a process that the members of the public would need to go through to be able to attend those meetings. Wayne's aware of that, and I understand he or others in the industry have already reached out to Keisa, who then goes to the chair of the committee, and the chair of that committee gives permission for other people to attend. The caveat being they can attend, but they're not recognized to speak or things along those lines. So that is at noon tomorrow, and I understand that through the Bail Bond Association, there'll be a representative there as well.
Okay.
The last couple of meetings have been canceled, so yeah, we haven't met for
3 or 4.
Yeah.
Thanks, Brett. Well, if there's nothing else, then we get a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you, everybody.
Thank you. That wasn't too bad.